Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of The Legal Geeks. With me is attorney Stephen Chu and Megan Hitchcock, both veterans of several mock trials that we've done, panels, and we're here to talk about the probate issues from the aftermath of Infinity War. Steve, Megan, how you both doing?
Very good, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about the borderline emotional abuse that was the end of Infinity War. Some of us are just now beginning to talk about it, and as I've told others, they're called the Avengers for a reason. It's going to be okay. It's the middle of the story. They needed something to avenge, and they have a lot of people now to go avenge. It's going
to
be
a lot to work with.
You know, I was thinking about it, and this is an aside, but the final scene of Spider-Man and Iron Man, Tony and Peter, I think the only thing in pop culture that has more of a gut punch than that scene is, you know, the death scene of Spock.
Yeah, that was sad.
I have been and always shall be your friend. And then Mr. Stark, I'm scared. Oh,
it's and I think there's a good argument that scene might top the end of Wrath of Khan for some people, especially younger fans who might not have grown up with Star Trek.
Right. And Tom Holland is just such a great actor. You know, my several people mentioned to me, and I agree with them that, you know, I think Stan Lee has said that Tom Holland is the closest to what he had in mind when writing Spider-Man, because he's so young and Spider-Man is supposed to be, you know, a teenager. And earlier, you know, in the movie, in Infinity War, when Iron Man tells him, you're an Avenger now, and you just see the look on his face, Tom Holland's face, as he lights up, Spider-Man lights up, and you can just, he doesn't say anything, but you can see how much it means to him. And then, you know, juxtapose that with the end when he vanishes and you see just the fear, because you remember, you know, he's still just a kid.
Well, there's that. And this is the beauty of the scene on how well it was directed and how well it was acted. But the look on Tony's face, that's a mix of fear, anger, loss, the every emotion all at once that Robert Downey Jr. channeled right there is no words are said, but the look on his face is extremely powerful. And I think for a modern generation, that might top Spock for some people. Even though if they haven't seen Wrath of Khan, I encourage them to, because...
Well, and Josh, you made... So for... What did we do that for Comic-Con like 3 years ago, 2 years ago, that you made me watch these? I like Star Trek, but I was never a huge Star Trek fan. And you made me watch several episodes in preparation for our panel. And I sobbed like a baby on that one.
And for purposes of our discussion, you know, we're sure that what Tony was really thinking when Peter passed was, oh my God, what are we going to do with your estate, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
What do I tell your aunt?
Yeah,
that's going to go over really well. Well, let's get into what's going to happen. We can talk about Peter and the other heroes that turned to dust. So for those who haven't taken a deep dive into probate law, or you're fortunate enough not to have had lost a family member or close friend, we encourage people to have wills. Lawyers are notoriously bad at not having wills for themselves, so mine's in my sock drawer. And
good to know, Josh. Thank you for telling me.
Yeah, thank you. You know, just should be updated. It's holographic, but we can talk about the forms of wills. Steve, could you walk us through, you know, the different types of wills that people could have?
So we have, you know, there are three types of wills that we've identified. There are the form wills, and these are relatively common. You know, they are prepared often typically by probate attorneys, standardized forms to make it easier for people, where they just have to, make choices at certain points, but they rely on standard boilerplate language so that the will have legal effect. You know, popular forms would include, and I'm looking at a copy of it right now, Quicken's Willmaker that is available at commonly available at stores, including Costco.
I'm just going to throw in my 2 cents and cut you off right now. Or LegalZoom, which I just did because I felt like I needed one. And then I got chastised by a probate attorney to not use that. But LegalZoom does have form wills.
I think even, if I recall correctly, some courts even have them available on their websites. I mean, those are going to be, I think, shorter and maybe a little more basic, whereas the Quicken Willmaker program does offer sort of a path, you know, where you make certain choices and then that, you know, builds the document as you go along. But that is certainly one way to go. So that would be the forms.
Which is the better than nothing approach.
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason a probate lawyer probably went after Megan is, you know, the form doesn't ask you in-depth questions, doesn't help you plan for caring for your pets or other family.
Hey, by the way, actually, I will give LegalZoom the credit. It did. And Josh, you're getting Hera, by the way. And you're getting all my Star Wars stuff. So, hey, you benefited. But it did ask if I wanted to bequeath certain things, and it did allow me to bequeath pets to people. So Josh is getting one of my dogs, and then I will say LegalZoom does walk you through it. I think the probate attorney chastised me because it's not specific enough, and it's very just basic language. It's just kind of boilerplate language that you can just shove stuff into.
Which is, again, better than nothing. So if that's what you need, go for it. But if you want something more with more substance, talk to a probate attorney who can really help with an estate plan. Which then brings us to statutory wills. And Steve, could you help us through statutory options?
So there are, you know, multiple different examples here. I mean, there's some definitions say that statutory wills are created by a state legislature written into state law. Others are definitions compare them pretty closely to form wills that are drafted by lawyers and, again, just involve some choices that people make, sort of a fill in the blank, check the box, inexpensive to prepare, but somewhat limited in use. Now, I think that for our purposes, you know, you would typically be more involved with an attorney here, though, and you would be getting, you know, better service, better advice, so to speak. If in an ideal situation, you know, one would hope that a person is planning well in advance with regard to their estate, and they actually do have the time to seek the counsel of a probate or estate attorney and draw up the documents that are appropriate for them. It looks like the definition of statutory wills is relatively broad, but feel free to chime in if you want to add anything there.
It's the form wills will have this as well, and Megan, want to hear your thoughts, but they do have witness requirements, and some might have notary requirements depending on the state. You know, California has, you know, you need two witnesses. I believe California requires them to witness the signing, actually see you sign it, and the testator says, like, I am of sound mind and this is my signature. New York has similar type rules that people.
And if I
go on.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. If I remember correctly, the witnesses cannot be the beneficiaries either.
That's typically correct.
Yeah. If you're getting anything under the will, no, you can't help prepare it. You know, when my mother was, you know, towards the end of her life and fighting cancer, she asked me to help her with a will, and I said, I can't, you know, because you want me to, you know, be a beneficiary. I can't do that. I looked up people who could help her, but, you know, I said, Now, the only way I could help is if I agree not to accept what you want to give me to avoid any conflicts of interest there.
Yeah. See.
All right.
Which then gets to holographic wills, which aren't as fun as they sound.
So, of course,
they sound like they come. They sound like they come straight out of the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland.
The image floating through my head is, you know, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. Okay, what's the will? Oh, here you go. Let's ask the hologram. Unfortunately, it's not quite that juicy, I suppose. But a holographic will is basically a handwritten instrument, typically prepared by the person whose will it is, otherwise known as the testator. Signed by them, and some states do not even recognize holographic wills. We're going way, way, way back, back in the day when, you know, people would, you know, write something on a piece of paper as they're about to pass away and sign it, and you know, some courts would recognize that. Over time, of course, as the laws evolved, you know, that's the process has become more sophisticated. But, you know, there are cases where courts have had to examine fairly bare documents that were handwritten to try to determine the intent of the testator and decide, well, is this legally enforceable, you know, or not? I recall some examples, too, where natural language wasn't always used either. There was one example I recall from my will and states, wills and trusts class where someone had written sort of a name, you know, and identified an item and then written an arrow to something else, and that it confused the court. But I pointed out that among folks with an engineering background or a computer science background, that actually means quite a bit to them. So it really kind of depends upon the audience, you know, that is looking at the document.
And our friend Christine Peake from McManus Faulkner, her firm had one of those, and like they made case law with the pictorial holographic will case of a like X arrow to Y type of pictorial holographic will, and the court found that to be valid.
Yeah,
these are sad cases, but it's happened of. Like a ship sinks, like there was a Coast Guard cutter lost on the Great Lakes. And I don't remember if it was this one or another ship. Guys were trapped in the engine room and hit bottom and they were still alive.
Oh.
And they painted messages on the bulkheads.
Oh my goodness.
Of goodbye letters or wills in some cases. And that would technically meet the requirements, because when it comes to a will, it's all about the testator's intent.
Right.
And if, you know, your last message is, you know, painted onto the bulkhead, like that sort of thing is, you know, it's there. So when we deal with wills and trusts, it can make people uncomfortable because we are talking about dying.
Yeah.
And, you know, on many levels, the law is fascinating with how it works because there's formulas, and we're about to get into kind of a high-level view of that with intestate succession. But, you know, it gets bleak because we're talking about, you know, the end of life, and that's the reason why a lot of people don't have wills,
right?
Because it makes them sad to think about.
Although, as some people would point out, sort of the devil's advocate position, I suppose, would be that this area of law is not so much about the person dying, but about those who are left behind. So if you think about it like that, it may be a little less morbid.
If you lose a family member and their life is a mess and they don't have a will, going through everything and trying to close out their mess is exceptionally hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's love your, one of the best gifts to give your family is to make that easy on them. Which then brings us to intestate succession. And Megan, can you help us with a high level view of that? Not having to get down too deep into the weeds.
Sure. So I'm having flashbacks to the seasons of Space and Trust in law school and bar prep, but So people who die without a will will have their estate disposed through intestate succession, which means it goes to their surviving heirs. So it's easy to think of it in kind of a flowchart kind of way, but it goes to property and things and money and everything like that. So the surviving spouse gets one half of community property. So anything you had during your marriage that's considered community property, and California is a community property state. So the wife or surviving spouse or husband or partner, I don't actually know if that actually works right now for partners, but wife or husband is entitled to one half of the community property. And then the spouse is also entitled to one half of quasi-community property, which is property acquired by the spouse outside of California, but would be considered community property in California. So if you have like a summer home or a winter home in Idaho or something like that, and you guys bought that together, then that's technically community property in California, so it's considered quasi-community property. And then the surviving spouse gets the following shares of the spouse's separate property, which is everything they bought on their own, either before the marriage or after, well, I guess it would be before the marriage. So it would be the entire intestate estate if the decedent did not leave any surviving children, parents, brothers, sisters, or issues of like nephews and nieces. They'll get one half of the intestate estate where the poor soul who died leaves only one child, or where they have no children but leave the parent, or if they get one third of the intestate estate if the decedent leaves more than one child, or if the decedent leaves one child and the issue of one or more, it gets very confusing. And I don't want to go into the weeds here, but for the most part, the spouse, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. I know it's spouse. I don't know in California if it includes partners yet, but for the most part, the spouse gets half unless there's children.
The code right now, I don't think references partners for intestate, but I do remember seeing partners listed in another part of the code. I would need to go through the code because we've been, you know, pretty progressive on this part of the law. And part of the reason why there was, you know, cases of adult adoption that took place that were, you know, gay couples before, you know, domestic partnerships were law, and before gay marriage was law, that, you know, people would move from the Midwest or, you know, back east to California because, you know, more accepting here. And
right. And
then when one of them would pass, you know, the family members from back east or the Midwest would challenge the validity of the will, saying, oh, he was of unsound mind because he was with, you know, this guy. And it was, you know, really ugly, bigoted type, you know, challenges to somebody's will because, you know, the grotesque people from another part of the country didn't, you know, wouldn't accept, you know, how their son or daughter was.
Right.
We've moved forward considerably since that time period. And that's like 70s, 80s, but I wouldn't be surprised if it still happened later. But that was the reason that people would adopt, you know, someone, or so that way they would get it through intestate succession. The courts frowned upon that because they would go, you guys are having sex and the parent-child relationship is incompatible with that. And so that's why that didn't last. But that was one of the ways that people were trying to, you know, protect their loved ones from bigotry.
Which leads me into, if there isn't a spouse, then if you don't have a will, then you don't have a spouse like me or Josh or anybody else who doesn't have a spouse, then it goes to your kids. And if you don't have kids, it goes to equal shares to your kids. And if you don't have kids, then it goes to your parents and equal shares to your parents. And then one parent, if there's only one parent. And then it'll go to your brothers and sisters. But if you don't have any brothers and sisters, it goes to your nieces and nephews, and it kind of moves its way around the family tree. So for the most part, it doesn't usually get that far unless most of your family is gone, but it's usually kids, then parents, then brothers and sisters. So.
You know, and for listeners who may be wondering, you know, this issue of people dying without a will, you know, and being intestate, it's more common than people may realize. You know, according to a Gallup poll that was published in May of 2016, only 44% of Americans nationwide had wills. So a majority did not. And, you know, if you look at the number breakdowns, you know, older folks, older, if you will, relatively speaking, of course, over the age of 65, roughly two-thirds had a will, about 68%. Whereas if you got to look at people under the age of 30, you were looking at about 14% of people that had wills. So it happens very frequently that people pass away without a will. So intestate succession kicks in and the state has to step in. You know, Megan was doing a good job of outlining all these steps, you know, the hierarchy, if you will. If at some point, as I recall, if at some point no one can be identified to be a beneficiary, the money actually will then what's called escheat, or just revert to the state at some point, to the government.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes. So it's that lesson of have a will, which brings us to, let's talk about what's going to happen after Infinity War. Now, let's, for those who still need a hug, back away from the ledge. The heroes are winning. This is the middle of the story. We want to see them overcome a great challenge. Thanos is that challenge. He's one of the greatest villains in the Marvel comics. You know, there are others I like to see in phases 4 and 5 who are equally, high risk, dangerous characters. I'm sure that after this, but Thanos is super evil. And he comes from this view of being an environmentalist, but the problem is he played God and deciding half of the universe needs to die. So literally, county buildings could be buried in the dust of people who live there, because they're going to need death certificates for probate purposes and life insurance. And that's going to be extremely difficult, because I don't think you're going to be able to get DNA off the dust. And so proving who died is problematic. Right. Saying like, no, that pile of dust was my cousin Jimmy. That pile of dust was X. And it doesn't look like normal dust, by the way. They disintegrate. That you can see something was afoot with how they died. Now the other.
Well, and what happens if there's wind? I mean, your cousin Jenny's gone.
Yeah. Or the end credits scene, you know, with Hill and Fury, where they see the helicopter crash that the pilot or pilots, whether it's one or both, died. And that meant the people on board, if they didn't die from the snap, they died in the crash.
Right. Collateral damage everywhere.
Yes. Now, imagine airliners where that happened. So that's significant, and just proving up in order to get into court that, no, these are my family members. Now, while there's good, you know, if we lose half the country, you know, there are the issues of how proportional is it? You know, is it 50% across the board in every city? Or could you have a situation where most of New York is still intact, but Atlanta's empty? Like, how's it, you know, what's the spread on it? And moreover, who dies is important. If everyone who knows how to run a nuclear reactor is dead, we're going to have big problems. If all the doctors are dead, we're going to have big problems. If the lawyers are dead, things can get messy because people are going to think it's the Old West all of a sudden, and society can start to crack that way. So when you lose 50% of the population, the amount of services that could collapse because of that is pretty extreme. So now this is terrifying beyond the body count, because governments could fall because of it, and society literally could come unhinged.
So, Josh, I don't mean to be crass, but I have to throw in something. Lawyers are like cockroaches, so we'll always be around. I think we'll survive the apocalypse.
We bounce back fairly strongly, and
we do.
There's a lot of us, so it could be good career openings for those who, you know.
Exactly. Like Thomas, you know, he was a janitor and he jumped up to a major, you know, prosecuting Dameron.
Yeah, it's just, you know, jobs for recent law school grads is a real issue. And
yeah, the job market's about to get a lot bigger for people, right? Or a lot more open.
Yeah, and it also depends how long this lasts, you know, that, yeah. You know, are we?
I was going to say, actually, yeah, kind of jumping to the end there. There are multiple theories, you know, as to Infinity War, like, are the people really dead, or, you know, prevailing theories, are they just trapped in the Soul Stone and they can come back? And that also presents just a fascinating sort of law school type of question, which is, let's say we think they're dead and you go through, as you've described, the process of having them declared dead. You get the death certificates, life insurance, and probate. Whether it be intestacy or just some sort of order probate, you know, through a will. And then, you know, at the end of all that, the property split up, divvied up, given to the beneficiaries who are still alive. And then suddenly the testator comes back and he's like, oh, well, guess what? I'm alive. I was just in the Soul Stone this whole time. So now what? You know?
That happens in a ton of TV shows recently.
Yes.
People come back and they've already been declared dead, and you're like, and they're like, hey, what am I going to do now? You have all my stuff.
There was a case from the early 20th century, because I blogged about it after the TV show Resurrection started, where the decedent, you know, was declared legally dead because he disappeared, and there was an issue of life insurance because he, you know, after 7 years declared dead, you know, wife got money, and around what, year 10 or something, the dude showed up again. And it's like, oh, well, what, you know, do we have to pay it back? Because the law is not designed for people to come back from the dead.
Yeah, nope.
Yeah, it's not an issue.
I think that was considered technologically impossible then, and probably still now, but who knows.
And when it happens, generally a religion starts around it. So
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, there's a reason it's special. So we get issues with death certificates, but let's just run through what could happen in the courts. So let's take the city of San Francisco. Population of, you know, over nearly 900,000. San Francisco can't get too big because it's a peninsula. We're not going to build into the water. So there's 870-some thousand people. Now, I took a look at the court calendar for the probate cases for actually this week. So like Monday, there was 10 cases heard. Tuesday, there was something like 30. Wednesday got up to like 40. And it's like, okay, so let's just assume between 10 to 40 cases a day are heard. You know, what that means, somebody filed a probate petition and they're going through the process. Well, on snap day, that, you know, the city of San Francisco, if it lost half the population, that's over 435,000 people who just died. You know, and the corresponding probate petitions that would need to be filed. And if you lost half the judges on the bench, so you're, you know, and they're not operating at full capacity right now. So let's just say that they're operating at 25% capacity, and there is a horrific increase, you know, because we're not designed for that. You know, if you look at LA County, it's worse. What is there in LA County? 8 million people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So 4 million probate petitions hit. Now, if they're children, that's different, but just 4 million adults.
And you're assuming that if half the judges are gone, you're assuming that the remaining half deal with probate. I mean, as it is right now, I think there's only a fraction that do probate in LA County, so it's not like all of them do it. So I would say, like, maybe a small percentage do probate law, and you'd be reducing that even further.
And it may be important to draw a distinction, too. I mean, the numbers tell a lot of the story right there. You know, as you pointed out, in San Francisco, on a typical day, maybe 40 cases are heard. And these are just petitions just for sort of orderly probate, if you will. 400,000 people pass away. So now you've increased that by a factor of, what, 10,000? And those, again, we're just assuming ordinary petitions where there's an orderly, discharge organization of the assets. But what if you get someone that challenges it, you know, and you have, you know, there are many famous cases about that. One of the more notable being, you know, the Anna Nicole Smith matter from a few years ago. You know, one case like that would grind the entire system to a halt while everyone else is kind of waiting for some disposition there. So I think the courts would just not even have the capability to deal with that type of a dispute.
Well, pivot to Santa Clara County, where you have, you know, all the Silicon Valley millionaires, and how crazy that could get, where you have, and we're down in LA, you know, famous people with lots of money and lots of property, and if they die intestate, that gets funky fast. So it would literally, you know, cripple the courts. Now, we might have other problems going on if, like, food can't be produced, you know, and we don't know if what the threshold for life was. That Thanos killed, you know, because if he killed half of all cattle in the country at the same time, like, food supply has been compromised. Or if we, oh, look, he did the Stalin thing and killed all the farmers, you know, you can literally see people starve to death, that a hit of this magnitude is worse than a war in some cases, because people make the system go, whether it's food, sanitation. If all the garbage men are dead, like, that's going to be a problem.
Right.
If the power shuts off, things are going to get messy.
There are a lot of fascinating issues that are brought up. And, I mean, we are frankly talking about an apocalyptic, you know, type of situation. And there are some really great science fiction parallels. You know, you can think of Mad Max, you know, post-apocalyptic. One, I think, very strong parallel actually would be Battlestar Galactica, you know, both series, where, you know, so much of humanity is decimated and the people end up leaving on, you know, one large cruiser and then a ragtag fleet. And they struggle with trying to reestablish society. You know, how do they do this? There aren't many lawyers or courts left. You know, their primary objective, of course, is food. First, they got to have farmers and grow food. And then after that, how do they distribute the food? And all the different trades, you know, how are they going to have people to provide important services, do repairs, build things? You're kind of starting over, you know, in many ways. And maybe something like that would have to occur in the aftermath of this level of an apocalypse.
I agree. And I do love BSG, both of them. The issues that are created show that Thanos didn't think this through. His idea of trying to make the universe better by killing half the population would end up getting more people killed. You know, it would not, it's not sustainable. You know, it's one thing to go like, hey, everybody, no more than 2 kids per family, because we can't have people having 10 kids anymore. That, you know, there just isn't the bandwidth for society. Like, that's one discussion. That's another one to go, it's time to thin the herd, and we're going to take out half of you. That's, again, there's a reason why that would be a war crime, because that's the sort of evil stuff that Hitler, Mao, Stalin, Pol Pot, Castro, like,
yes,
all did, and we're making society better, so some of you are going to have to check out.
Right. And all of those examples you cited of people who throughout history have committed atrocities and who history have judged to be, you know, evil, for lack of a better term, you know, they all really felt that they were justified and felt that they were doing the right thing. You know, no one ever sees themselves as the bad guy, quote unquote, right? Thanos had a very, you know, to some people, it would be a very compelling justification that, okay, I'm doing something horrible, but it's for a good reason. And look at these planets where I've done this. They now have record, you know, growth and people are eating and things like that. So,
but he's playing God.
And he is. You're right.
He doesn't have the right to do that.
Absolutely.
And that's why a war crimes trial would be highly appropriate for him.
Yes. If we could overpower him somehow.
Squirrel Girl.
Squirrel Girl.
That's, and she's supposed to be coming to Freeform, so the answer's on its way.
Or if we were going with the comic continuity, you know, we could ask his girlfriend Death to kind of intervene because he would always listen to her.
There's that. I enjoyed the pivot with not having her. You know, when, you know, at the end of the first Avengers movie, you know, the court Death moment, you know, seemed to be a pure callback to the comics. I thought, like, okay, yeah, cool. And what they did instead was original, and it doesn't make him, I mean, he's still a psychopath, but he's a different type of psychopath. It's far more complex than being the literal lover of death. Yeah. And I mean, I love the Russo brothers for how they do a story. You know, they nailed Winter Soldier. And they absolutely hit this out of the park. And the way that they're able to handle all those characters in one movie and have it make sense was good.
Oh, it's remarkable. And Kevin Feige, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and the rest of the team, I mean, they really know what they're doing. They know the comics as the source material, and they know they got to change it slightly, you know, to make it work for the movies. So, you know, you can disagree with the creative decisions, but there are reasons why they have done what they have done, and arguably it's working.
Yeah, because when I think back to the original Thanos War in the comics, that, you know, was centered around the original Captain Marvel, Mar-Vell, the Kree,
yes,
soldier, mm-hmm, and Adam Warlock. And those, yeah, characters haven't been introduced, even though the closing scene from the end credits is the Captain Marvel symbol. So look
for Carol Danvers, Captain, yeah, Marvel. Yeah.
After she changed her outfit to honor the Kree Captain Marvel.
Right, right.
So we do have that connection. And I do love the original Kree Captain Marvel a lot. So I know we'll see him in the upcoming movie. I just don't know how it's going to be. But I'm ecstatic to see Carol.
Yes.
And watching Brie Larson on Instagram, it's like, I can't wait to see her in the uniform do her thing. So, but let's focus on these characters and these deaths and apply some probate law that we've just discussed. So Doctor Strange now lives in a nice magic mansion that has lots of magical items that he could be the owner of. Let's assume that he is, that he lives there. He's the Sorcerer Supreme. It's his. Well, he's not married. We don't know if he has a will. I hope he did. But if he didn't have a will, or excuse me, if he did have a will, Wong likely could be a beneficiary.
Right.
Or Dr. Christine Palmer could be a beneficiary of his estate. But if he didn't have a will and there's no family members, all that could go to the state.
So why wouldn't that go back to the temple?
The order.
Why wouldn't, yeah, all that stuff go back to the temple? Because it's all technically he's just protecting it, and he's the.
Yeah, I think Megan's got a good point there, actually, because in many ways the Sorcerer Supreme is a title that is sort of passed,
right,
from person to person. Yeah, he's the current Sorcerer Supreme. In the comics, I think Brother Voodoo succeeded him.
Briefly.
Yeah. And, you know, he lives in the Sanctum Sanctorum, but he's surrounded by all these just amazing artifacts. But he's more of a steward or custodian of the title rather than, you know, the title itself.
Custodian.
Yeah.
Is he? But again, that would be the...
Like, I feel like those are not actually his problem. I mean, yes, the cloak is, because it basically jumped on him, but the rest of the stuff, I feel like he's just guarding and keeping safe, but it's not all technically his.
That it's owned by the Order instead.
Correct. Perhaps, yeah. And I think it would go back to them.
So, or they've never lost control of it. They would just assign Wong or somebody else to guard it. Good argument, and that could be it. And
the attorneys for the Order would certainly take that position.
Yeah. And the state of New York might want it, but
they might disagree. Yeah.
And that's why we have lawsuits. But that's why it's important to have a will, so this sort of thing spelled out, or if there is a like a trust agreement written, or some deed that has instructions for what's supposed to happen, so that way a judge can look at this and go like, "No, kids, this is how it's going to play out."
You know, but what you were starting to hit on, Josh, is also an interesting question, which is, if Dr. Strange had no will, Stephen Strange has no will, and if he is found somehow to be the owner of all these magical artifacts, you know, the Eye of Agamotto and all these other just remarkable things, what happens to them if you cannot find a beneficiary and they now revert to the state? Oh my God, what is the state of New York going to do with these items? That's a whole story in and of itself. You know, one could imagine sort of the Indiana Jones moment at the end with all the crates of amazing items that are filed away because no one knows what to do with them. Or if they're smart, you know, maybe they enlist the help of S.H.I.E.L.D. or someone else to say, okay, we don't know what we're doing, so you might have people that know what they could do with this, so help us out perhaps.
Yeah, they could go like, hey, we remember when those Nazis were secretly running S.H.I.E.L.D., so we're still not comfortable with that. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, who do you trust with this? I don't know.
Yeah, it's putting it in a box might be the safest plan to go, we're just going to label this 804 and leave it the hell alone and walk away.
I mean, the list of magic users, high-level magic users in the Marvel Universe, I mean, it's not very high. You know,
and it's that way for a reason. I mean, there are a number of magic characters, but we haven't seen a Dr. Druid or Brother Voodoo.
Right.
That would be neat to Cloak and Dagger, which has been excellent. If you haven't watched it, binge it now. It's a ton of fun. That takes place in New Orleans, and so Brother Voodoo could be introduced there. And
that would be fantastic. Yeah,
I would love that.
Sorry, go ahead.
I have the nice action figure, the Legends one. So good stuff.
There was a good storyline years ago where Doctor Strange was trying to find a successor, and it became Brother Voodoo for a while. But there were a number of candidates, and one of them was, and I'm trying to remember his name, starting with a D, I think he was like the son of a demon or something. But he was actually a very well-grounded, very caring, sympathetic guy, and very powerful too. But it showed there were not very many candidates, and it really kind of told, it showed how the list of high-level, powerful magic users is very low.
Yes, still... Doctor Strange now twice has shown the power of contract law.
So the number of people who you could even get to be experts to help you with all the artifacts in Sanctum Sanctorum is probably going to be very small.
Yep. There's a reason why lawyers and doctors frequently get along, and Strange is a good example of that.
Yeah.
Well, let's pivot over to another character known for magic, and that'd be Scarlet Witch. Now, it's hex magic. And if you get into the comics, there's a lot of history with Scarlet Witch. And I adore her in the movies. But she doesn't really have any family left. Not that we know. And Vision wasn't a real boy.
Although, remember, she had kids with him in the comic. Although later that was kind of undone in House of M.
Yeah, and then they disappeared through. That was the John Byrne storyline. Mm-hmm. That it was her will that was keeping them in existence.
Yes, right.
And so, like, losing the kids pushes her over the edge, and Vision turning all white, and yeah, good old John Byrne. Where is he now? So in the movies, her brother's dead. She's with Vision and wants a relationship, and Vision's a completely different podcast discussion about his legal rights. What happens to her property?
You know, so if we take a step even further from the 10,000 foot view, there is another contract issue, which is the rights to the other characters. You know, her father is Magneto, who is in a different movie universe at the moment, at least under Fox. However, with the recent news of Disney acquiring some of those assets, there is speculation that the universes may finally be merged. So, yes, her sibling Pietro is gone, but her father could be around. So even if she died without a will, you know, her father could stand to inherit whatever assets she may have.
So the first time we see Magneto in a Marvel movie will be in court.
It's to show up to grab his daughter's belongings and say, okay, peace out, you know.
Spoiler alert, by the way, if you didn't know, Magneto was her dad.
yeah, that's or if you're watching The Gifted, you know, you have Polaris, the other daughter.
Yeah.
Also, highly recommend that show. Lots of good, you know, they hide out at the Kirby Garage. So nice little Easter eggs there. Okay, so that'd be a fun way to see Magneto. And there are rumors they just might scrap the X-Men movies that were in development and start fresh. And I would be okay with that.
I would be okay with it.
Yeah, if they're really are concerned that they're unwatchable, just put it to bed. Let the people who know and love the characters write movies that work, and we live in one integrated universe.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the Fox movies, but it would be really interesting to see if they did try to restart them, you know, in the MCU.
They couldn't. The Fox movies have been hit and miss. And
yeah.
I mean, some of them are you know, the first one, amazing.
Yes. 1999, yeah.
Because it proved it could work.
Yes.
The following two were three running it into the ground.
I would agree.
First Class and Days of Future Past, fantastic.
Pretty good.
And Apocalypse was so.
And then the recent the Logan movie, you know, sort of the old man Logan type of take, that I thought was remarkable, actually.
Yeah, I'm surprised that didn't have Oscar nominations, but that's
fantastic. Right. With X-23, I mean, just outstanding.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Beautiful, well done.
With Patrick Stewart losing his mind, but he will come back now as Jean-Luc Picard. So.
Different podcast.
Yes.
And for the record, I'd be fine with Star Trek viniculture of him just tending to his grapes, giving folksy advice about the prime directive and wine pairings. I would be happy.
The opening scenes of All Good Things.
Just him. Can I help? Yeah. Focus. So, Black Panther, leader of a country. We at least have seen their secession plan, and will that mean his sister, if she's still alive, will she take over at least temporarily? I don't know, but I hope so.
Wow, so we're talking about, I guess, sort of different things now, though. You know, the distribution of his assets versus his succession to the throne, his successor to the throne. And we would have to respect Wakandan law at that point. I mean, their law would control.
And since they were the scene of the final battle, I think they should be the ones appointed by Earth for the war crimes trial. I think they should have the presiding judge.
Right. You know, if we go with, as you know, Megan outlined, the intestacy succession, you know, once T'Challa is gone, then, I mean, he was married. Weren't they married at the end of Black Panther?
No.
Were they not?
No.
Nope. But he definitely leaning towards.
Yeah. Okay. So if they're not legally married and they're not common law, you know, married, then it should go the order, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Megan, but I think to his sister first, cause he has no kids. So to his sister, to his mother, and then his sister.
It would go to his mom first before it would go to his sister. If we're just talking about his assets, but yeah, if we're talking about the throne of Wakanda, then that's up to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the throne would go to the sister. She would have the first right to it.
Assuming that women can lead there, but yes.
I think they can, because they seem, that doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem to be an issue.
They seem very empowered, which is great. Yeah.
The, his mom would take the property.
Yeah.
So that's my gut feeling.
Yeah.
Now let's,
his mom would take, oh yeah, it would go, I think it goes, yeah, it goes to his mom. Sorry. Yes.
Now let's talk about the gut punch we began with. Spider-Man, who's the minor. I think everything would just flow to his aunt because his parents are gone and he has no siblings.
Yeah, she's his legal guardian. Correct. And I believe, now I'm trying to remember, you know, all the years of Spider-Man history, if they ever actually formally adopted Peter Parker. And I don't know if they ever did. But I believe his parents were declared dead at some point.
Ben Parker. I thought, oh God, there's a Spider-Man history goes way back.
Yes.
And there's been retcons. Mm-hmm. I think with his parents' death, she became the legal guardian because that was either in a will or she was the, you know, her and Ben were the last living family members.
Yeah. And Mary and Richard Parker, if I recall their names correctly, I mean, you know, there's a story that they died on a plane crash or they were spies or whatnot. But I think they were declared dead. So yeah. Ben and May, you know, took over.
If they were SHIELD agents or whatever they were. Yeah. Well, let's talk about how we destroy the U.S. economy even further. And that's life insurance, because this is where, you know, it's a matter of contract law with this. And when somebody dies and they have a life insurance policy, you submit a form with the death certificate to say, hey, this person died. I'm the beneficiary under the life insurance policy. Pay me money. Let's just do a little mental exercise of how this could end horribly for the United States. That, you know, our population is, significant in the, 326 million category. Well, let's just say that we have 163 million people plus who die. Assuming, let's just go with 20%. That might be gracious, but let's just say 20% of those who died had a life insurance policy. So that's, 32 million people? Well, if each policy was $150,000, which is kind of normal, there could be people who would just have $50,000. There could be people who have $1 million. But let's just say that as a baseline, that 20% averages out to $150,000 a person, a decedent payout. That would be over $4 trillion. In insurance payouts. That's like budget worthy of the United States type amount of money. And that's horrifying because the insurance industry doesn't have $4 trillion lying around to do those kind of payouts. And they would fight like hell in challenging validity of death certificates and going, prove that this person's dead, in order to just not be crippled. And it'd be interesting if there's provisions within life insurance policies that they could say this was an act of God or something to challenge whether or not they had to do a payout. That, you know, if there's a terrorist attack, do you pay out? And that could be, look at the minute language of the life insurance policy.
Yeah.
And in the MCU where they've had alien invasions and giant monsters come down from the sky, has insurance changed there because of that?
And I mean, you know, we could do multiple podcasts, I think, on those issues right there. You know, I mean, so there are a host of just outstanding intellectual exercises there. But as you point out, you know, insurance, when you purchase insurance, it's very special because you're purchasing security in a time of need. And the idea is that you typically don't need it, but it is for that rainy day. And insurance payments typically are made from the premiums. Well, you know, the insurance companies make money from their premiums, and they have set aside reserves, and then they have some capital working cash that they can then use to pay out to pay out benefits and keep running. But it's not unlike, in some ways, what a bank does. You know, how they have roughly, I think it's 20% of the actual money that's in the bank. They only actually have 20% of it on hand for people to withdraw. So at the Great Depression, you know, when there was a run on the banks only didn't have enough money, even though theoretically the money's still there, but they didn't have hard cash to give out to people. An example from recent history would be Hurricane Katrina, and how suddenly there were just multitudes of insurance claims, homeowners and otherwise, where people's had lost so much and they were making insurance claims to try to get things. And the insurance companies, you know, required a lot of documentation. Some people felt they fought hard. Some feel they fought too hard and made it very difficult for people to get benefits. And so FEMA, you know, had to step in also to try to prop up the process and make sure that people got paid. But, you know, if this were to happen, you know, looking at Infinity War, I think it's reasonable to say that the life insurance companies would not just gladly hand over bags of money and then bankrupt themselves, because, you know, number one, they're just not capable because they don't have that much money. And number two, just the sheer logistical nightmare that would be involved in proving things up. Again, it would be grinding to a halt. You may have to have something where, you know, similar to the government calling a bank holiday, they may have to freeze sort of the insurance industry for a little bit to call a timeout so that people could sort things out.
Agreed. Now, granted, there might be still mass rioting for those who are still left alive and other things, so people might not be heading toward the courthouses yet or filing probate petitions or trying to get insurance claims, because they do get hit without warning. Like, yeah. There was the assault on New York by the children of Thanos, but they, and that's still big. It's still a giant spinning donut in the sky, you know, scaring the hell out of everyone. But that was it, you know, besides the attack in Wakanda.
Yeah.
So this comes out of left field. So if people are just hanging out doing everyday life on a Wednesday and, you know, 80% of the people in your office turn to dust before your eyes, that's hard.
And, you know, maybe that is an underlying theme to what we were talking about tonight. You have pointed out correctly on many occasions, and many lawyers, I think, you know, will all subscribe to this, which is the idea that in a civilized society, we resolve our disputes typically through the court system. It is there to help us resolve disputes peacefully, orderly. There are rules, and that this is how we resolve disputes over property, ownership, money, any number of things, you know, criminal acts. But if you were to suddenly lose half the population, would people still be able to go to the court system to handle their disputes, or would you see a breakdown in society and rioting in the streets and just a complete you know, devolving of societal standards?
There could be another reaction of people rally that, you know, it could be like Pearl Harbor. We didn't, you know, the country didn't lose it. They organized.
Yeah. They galvanized, right? Yeah.
It could be something of that magnitude, but on a planetary scale. You know, it'd be ironic if it's the mass planetary attack that unites humanity to go, oh, hell no. Mm-hmm. We're getting over this right now. And everyone pull an oar because we got some work to do.
Well, that's a great optimistic view that I think, you know, we all hope would happen. You know, there are a lot of analogies we could draw from history, but one that jumps out to me just from the comics is Dark Knight Returns. In that comic, do you remember, like, Gotham has the worst night ever where things are burning
and people are starting to riot and the police are losing control. But then suddenly, and it, I think the way Frank Miller wrote it was just very poetic and eloquent. He said, so, you know, someone reached out a hand to pull somebody up. Another person grabbed a bucket and passed it to another person. People formed a line and started putting out fires. And, you know, one person at a time, people came together.
Or real life. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Megan.
I was going to say, it's funny that you went to The Dark Knight, because I automatically went to Ghostbusters, too, when they all started singing, you know, to get the Statue of Liberty to move.
Yes.
Everybody singing. So that was my pull. Or Independence Day, which was global.
Yes.
Because, you know, we got invaded, and then all the countries worked together. So those were my pulls.
There's 9/11, which...
Oh, well, there's that.
Yeah. Boat lift. The fact that you had ferry boat captains on their own start helping evacuate Manhattan, and, you know, it was the largest, you know, the only thing bigger than that initially was Dunkirk.
Dunkirk, right.
Which had like 850 boats participated in Dunkirk. This topped Dunkirk and people moved, and it wasn't organized. It wasn't, you know, there was no planning meeting for this. It was people deciding to cowboy up and go do the right thing. And the Coast Guard had the wherewithal to recognize what was going on, and they stepped up and helped with vessel traffic control to make sure everything ran. But people were just, you know, piloting boats right up to breakwaters and loading people on and getting people out of Manhattan. If there was a planetary type attack, you know, which is different. Like, buildings aren't crashing down here. It's literally 50% of the population of Earth turns to dust before, you know, the eyes of everybody. Those left, I would hope, don't go into riot mode.
Right.
That they go into organized hell no mode, because we do have historical precedents of people not cracking under that kind of pressure, but going above and beyond. So that's my, I don't know if they're, how they'll address it in the next movie. You know, we still don't know what it's going to be named, other than it should cause people to lose their minds, because it sounds like they're going to pick something from the comics that we'll know and love.
Right. And just piggybacking off that, Josh, I mean, those are remarkable, you know, examples throughout history. And you're right, there have been numerous examples. You know, it's easy to fall into the pessimistic side and just think, wow, there's so many dark chapters in humanity. But at the same time, there are so many inspiring chapters as well, the type that just give you chills to think about people doing good things, people coming together. One would certainly hope that, you know, after seeing sort of the worst of things, we would then see the best of humanity if it were a situation like Infinity War and people would come together. You know, nobody knows. You know, it would be a fascinating area to explore that.
Well, I mean, you know, Megan had a long drive home tonight because of, you know, the fires in, you know, in California. And, you know, it's, you can still see the haze where I am. And people are responding positively, you know, with clothes being donated. I mean, for people who lost everything, others are stepping up to help. So, you know, that's one of the remarkable things about humanity, that we do step up. I don't know how they'll depict that in the next movie, or if we'll see it in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, the response, you know, the rally. It'd be interesting what they do, because we know Cap and Tony are going to get together. We know Cap will be given back his shield for the end game. You know, I'm very excited, because we have creative people who love these characters, who I think will do something very special.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, agreed.
So before we close out, you know, Megan, who's your favorite Avenger?
Ooh, tough call. You know, I do. I always love the snarky, so this kind of smart ass. So I'm kind of torn. I do love Tony Stark, but I do love Ant-Man. I do love Ant-Man. Because I love Paul Rudd. I think I just love Paul Rudd because he's kind of a smart ass and he's funny. So, but I like Tony's personality too. I don't know. One of those two is probably my fave.
Steve?
So I'll give sort of two answers there. First, I'll defer to my boys who love Ant-Man, and my older son, when he was 4, dressed up as Ant-Man / Giant Man for Halloween. And he was the only one, because there were no movies at the time, and Ant-Man was an obscure Marvel character. You know, he was not Captain America or Thor. But he had done such a good job telling his whole class about it that they were ecstatic when they saw him, you know, come to school in that outfit, which he later wore to Comic-Con. And Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, was one of the few places he could wear that and be recognized for what he was at that time, because we're still about, you know, 7-8 years before any Ant-Man movies come out at that point. So, you know, my boys love Ant-Man. For myself, it's hard to say. I love Daredevil, although I don't think he's ever been a formal member of the Avengers. Under, you know, Brian Michael Bendis's run of New Avengers, Captain America personally recruits a new team. He goes and offers a position to Daredevil, who says no because he has too much going on in his life. You know, at that point, he's been outed, his identity and all that. So I don't know if that would count for him being an actual member of the Avengers. I mean, he was certainly offered the position. You know, failing Daredevil, I would say it's hard to argue with Captain America. You know, I love what he stands for, what he does, and just the sheer force of will, the respect that he commands throughout the Marvel universe and even in the DC universe. You know, when they had the crossover, the DC heroes said they wanted him to be the leader. So I just think that's remarkable, because in terms of superpower, his power level is not really that high. You know, he doesn't lift airplanes or fly or anything like that. It's really more, you know, his character is more about the heart and his moral compass. So I like that a lot. Him and Spider-Man, I think I love both of them. And you, Josh?
It's a tough one. So I don't want to say it's a tie, but, you know, and sometimes it depends on my mood, but my two favorites are Cap and Thor. And for different reasons, you know, to go with the movie line, you know, from Winter Soldier, you know, I'm, you know, here with you to the end of the line, to Thor, you know, it's what heroes do.
Yeah.
Those are good mantras.
Oh yeah.
Of, you know, loyalty, fidelity to cause, and like what Joe Johnston did with the first Captain America movie, to what we see in Winter Soldier, you know, to the end scenes of Infinity War with, you know, just the, you know, Cap looking defeated.
Yeah.
I mean, again, gut punch. Thor, I mean, Thor Ragnarok being such an amazing film.
Oh, outstanding.
Yeah. And, you know, the way that, you know, they figured out how to write Thor in the movies. And, you know, because I grew up with Walt Simonson's Thor, mm-hmm. run on Thor.
Yes.
And I loved that run so much. From the Assault on Hell to the Death Curse to the War with Salter. You know, and to, you know, the final big battle with, you know, the World Serpent. All of that was just so amazing. And in what Jason Aaron's doing right now with Thor, you know, being the God of Thunder again, slightly less powered, but having multiple hammers that he uses, that's mm-hmm. a ton of fun. But from Thor getting Stormbreaker, you know, turning around with Rocket and Groot, you know, more speed Rabbit. I absolutely love that. And Thor being, you know, being the strongest Avenger, you know, and Stormbreaker being, since it's made by, you know, this, you know, the same dwarf, you know, they being the only thing that could cut through the, you know, the Infinity Gauntlet to harm Thanos.
Peter Dinklage.
That was such a cool. People yeah. lost it. So oh, lost it.
Amazing.
I don't fault Thor, you know, the same way that I fault Star-Lord, because, like, if you're in, you know, police officers and soldiers are taught aim for the chest. You know, yes. it's the engine room, it's the target.
That's right, center of mass.
Yeah, and so where does he, you know, he doesn't try cutting off the arm with a kill shot because that takes great aim. He doesn't aim for the head, which is a smaller art, you know.
Right.
And not only that, I don't think he was purposely trying to be vindictive. Now, granted, I would have had no problem if Hawkeye shot Thanos through the head. And fan theories ruin movies.
Yes.
I wouldn't be surprised if Hawkeye lost his family. And
so, yes.
And so when he comes swinging out of retirement, he's going to be a very angry archer.
So Hawkeye, without doing too deep a dive, I mean, I still feel conflicted. I mean, I love the movie character, but he's really based on the Ultimate Universe version of Hawkeye, where he's a Black Ops SHIELD agent, not the original comic Hawkeye, who is the trick arrow shooter from the carnival, you know, and also an outlaw and distrustful of the government, and also married to Bobby Morse for a time, at least, mm-hmm. Mockingbird, an agent of SHIELD. But it's, you know, very different versions of that character. I just want to circle back to one thing, you know, when we're talking about our favorite characters and sort of what makes them great heroes. I was talking about Captain America and how it's, you know, in one of his origin stories, the four-part Sentinel of Liberty story, the general that kind of selects him to be the member of the Super Soldier program, one reason he selects him is because, you know, although he's the weakest, physically weakest candidate, he won't give up. You know, when he falls, he gets up and he keeps going no matter what. And the general says, you know, the soldier in him says, go for heart every time. And this kid has more heart than anyone. And then with regard to Spider-Man, J. Michael Straczynski, one of my favorite authors, I was mm-hmm. privileged to attend one of his panels at Comic-Con in San Diego years ago when he was writing Spider-Man. And he said that his take on Spider-Man was that Peter Parker is the main character, not Spider-Man. And that Peter got his powers from the spider, but he got his strength from Aunt May and Uncle Ben. And I thought, wow, that captures the character right there. You know, just remarkable insight. I mean, the character is about the strength he gets, you know, from his loved ones. And even without the spider power, he would still be a hero.
The movie take on him is a tad different because we don't have the uncle. They didn't show the origin story for the third time, thank God.
Yes, thank goodness, right.
Grateful for that. So we don't quite have the Uncle Ben storyline, but I really adore the connection with Tony.
Yeah.
And it's been some of Robert Downey Jr.'s most endearing acting.
Yeah.
Especially in Homecoming with, you know, that's on me.
Yeah, if you die, that's on me, right?
And that was clearly on Tony's face when Peter turns to dust.
Yeah.
And this is like the godfather of superhero movies.
Yeah.
I don't even put it on my list of favorites because it's in a class by itself. Yeah.
Well, it's out on DVD on Tuesday, and my kids can't wait. So,
while we're doing this post, to talk about it and prep for that, because right. it's such a good movie. Like when I saw it, you know, and came home, you know, I just like laid in bed and stared at the ceiling, like not sure how to process what I had seen.
Yeah.
Did either of you have similar experiences?
What do you think, Megan?
Yeah, I mean, thanks to Josh, I actually knew what was coming at the end, but,
spoiler.
I was kind of devastated, but, I learned my lesson after Star Wars and stuff and other movies where they left you hanging, like they had to do three. And, so I'm always aware of you know, we got to cut it off for time and they'll come back. So yes, but I did walk out of that going, wow, they just killed off half the characters. Awesome. So, yeah. Mm.
You know, so that was Infinity War was the first Marvel movie to which I took my entire family. And my younger son, you know, gets very nervous and scared in certain movies. So I didn't think he was going to make it, but he actually did. And I think he, you know, he was trying to be brave, and you know, I was holding his hand a lot, or, you know, hugging him when he was a little nervous. But he really got into it. And both of them just loved it, and they've been in love with Marvel since then, to my great joy. And towards the end, when we saw all the people dying, and people had been guessing who would die, and so many people guessed wrong. You know, a lot of people thought the big three, Thor, Iron Man, and Cap, are going to have to go, but they didn't. It was a lot of other people. You know, Black Panther dies. Well, how can that happen? He's got more movies coming. You know, Spider-Man dies. Wait a second. He's got a movie in production too. I mean, the Guardians are gone. Wait, you know, how can that possibly be? You know, they have more movies too. So that, it was just so unexpected. And the part that really got me the most was Spider-Man passing away. Just him, you know, you see the terror, you know, as we discussed earlier, he's a kid and he says, "I'm scared." And that just hit me right to the core. And then, you know, Tony trying to hold him and comfort him and knowing that he could not. Perhaps it's because I have two boys, but you know, I just, you know, that definitely brought me to tears, and you know, just gave me chills, and I could not stop thinking about that for quite a while. So, you know, very, very moving.
Yeah, I remember when, you know, we texted about it, and I'd seen the movie, and you texted like, "Hey, is it okay that I take my kids?" And my reply text was something along the lines of, "Hey, I think you should see it first, make a decision." And your text back was like, "I already have tickets for tomorrow at noon." I thought like, oh, golly, no. They'll be fine. I'm sure they'll be fine.
Yes, right.
That's what I was telling myself. The kids will be fine.
They'll be fine. Maybe dad won't, but you know.
They'll be okay. It's feeling really uncomfortable. Everything will be okay. Tell the boys that.
I appreciate the vote of support and you trying to warn me off, but it was already too late. So.
it's like, well, I don't want to spoil it for Steve, but I don't want the children crying either.
So. Yeah, no. They handled it in stride.
Yeah, but it's okay to, I mean, again, Wrath of Khan, people walked out of there sobbing.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And, you know, a lifetime later, people say that's their favorite Star Trek movie because of the effect it has, the emotional impact.
Yes.
It'll be interesting to see as time progresses if people feel the same about Infinity War because of the emotional connection they have to the characters and what happens, if it's something that they love because of that, or if it leaves them hollow and, you know, emotionally scarred instead. I don't know the answer to that question. Yeah. It could be both, but I don't know. Because of the emotional draw. And that last fight is just so good.
Oh, it's amazing.
The fight on Titan and the fight in Wakanda.
Wakanda, yeah.
So with that, I want to thank you both for joining us to take a deep dive into probate law and get excited for Infinity War as it comes out on Blu-ray and DVD. It's already out on digital. And hopefully we'll all be at various shows in the near future. But until then, stay geeky, America.